genius.
The fully realized vision of an authentic American genius.
We need your brain.
Don't you have a brain in your head?
Then I will have to adjust your brain a bit.
Every day, Billy the Brain talks with the best guests in America.
Cool.
About business.
The boss that works for you.
Entertainment. Sports.
Turn now to sports.
And the local community.
Radio keeps its eye on local events.
It's time for brainstorming.
My brain is like mush.
With Billy the Brain.
Sounds like fun. Let's go.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Hi, this is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We're live every day, Monday through Friday at 10 o'clock here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. You can also hear us streaming over the internet at brainstormingonline.com. My goal is to bring you interviews with thought leaders in business, entertainment, sports, and the local community. Together, we'll listen to what these people say and relate it to how we live and work right here in Ventura County. Brainstorming with Billy the Brain is smart radio with sharp questions aimed at intelligent guests. It's talk radio done right for the 21st century. If you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008, or if you're outside of the area code, it's area code 805-639-0008. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is politics and leadership. Each of my guests will discuss his subject that relates to leading, whether it's in politics, in business, or in life. My first guest worked for United Press International and on several political campaigns, including his own. He's turning his attention to presidential races and on the losers to determine what impact the losers had on the nation. We'll discuss his latest book, Almost President. My second guest is the executive director of a nonprofit foreign policy analyst and a former senior analyst in the polling division of the 1988 Bush campaign. He exposes how American presidents and diplomats have sold out our interests and our security to the Arab interests, Saudi Arabia in particular. We'll discuss his book, The Arab Lobby. My third guest is a former college basketball player for DePaul and an ESPN college basketball analyst. We'll discuss what he's learned about becoming a pro both in business and in life. And if you want to join in the conversation, you can call us at 639-0008. Scott Ferris is the former bureau chief for United Press International and a political columnist who has interviewed many of the men and women who have sought the presidency over the past 30 years. He has managed several political campaigns and was the Democratic Party's 1998 congressional nominee for Wyoming's at-large district. That's a seat that was once held by former Vice President Dick Cheney. His loss in that race led to ruminations on the role that losers play in democracy. Scott has worked as a senior policy and communications advisor to former U.S. Senators Malcolm Waldrop, who is a former Wyoming Governor Mike Sullivan, former California Governor Gray Davis, and former Portland, Oregon Mayor Vera Katz, as well as for two university presidents and the Bishop of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Cheyenne. He was the first American journalist selected to participate in the Georgetown University School of Foreign Services International Leadership Seminar. Scott's first book is titled Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Welcome to the show, Scott. How are you today?
I'm great, Bill. Thank you. It's great to be on Brainstorming on KKZZ.
Well, thank you so much for being my special guest. And I was intrigued by your book. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is why focus on the losers in key presidential races? I mean, it's the winners who lead the country and have the greatest opportunity to shape the country. So what can studying the losers tell us about our country and about us as people?
Well, because two things. One is that covering the winners in a campaign only tells you half the story. Every campaign is a choice between two sides. And it's important sometimes to know what people didn't choose is what they did choose. And so studying the losers provides the fuller picture of what's actually happening in politics and our history.
Okay.
But the other thing, as you noted, is that actually losers do have a great opportunity to shape history and to shape our political system. And some of these men, even though they lost the presidency, probably had a greater impact on American history and American politics than some of the men who won. And so there's some really extraordinary people profiled in the book who really have shaped the politics of America today.
Without a doubt. And we'll talk about some of those people because some of those races were very contentious and very, very memorable. But you assert in the book that the concession speech that's made by the losing candidate is, in many ways, what defines democracy. So how so?
Well, because a democracy doesn't work unless the losers are willing to give their consent to be governed by the winners. We see around the world all sorts of democracies, and it's not just sort of the new unstable democracies in maybe Africa or Latin America, but even in places like France, where after an election, people on the losing side say we don't accept the results, and they go out and they riot. There's a lot of chaos. Sometimes there's even a civil war. And it's we're fortunate in the United States that really from the very beginning of the Republic, there was this tradition established that you would lose relatively graciously, at least as graciously as you felt you could be, and accept the results and agree that the people spoken, majority rules, and that the losers will not take to the streets, but they'll just try to go back to the next ballot, the next election, to reverse that and try to get their program implemented. So I think it's a very important in terms of the stability of American democracy, the fact that it's endured for more than 200 years, is that you have the fact that we have this ingrained in ourselves that we accept the results of an election. Sometimes those results don't seem fair, but we know that in order for the whole system to work, that's the way it has to be.
My guest is Scott Faris, author of the book Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Now, Scott, your book really focuses on modern presidential races from about the 1820s to today. Some of the early elections, though, between our founding fathers may have been more telling about how our country's democracy progressed. I mean, if you look at it, a battle between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson in 1796, for instance, really shaped two very competing political ideologies there and helped to shape our country profoundly for the next 190-something years. Agree or disagree?
No, I agree. And actually, I give actually Alexander Hamilton probably a bigger role than John Adams, though Adams was certainly a Federalist like Hamilton. But sure, I think really the history of America is kind of the struggle between the two philosophies embodied by Jefferson and Hamilton, one saying we need as little government as possible and the emphasis should be on individual freedom, and the other one saying, no, we need a very active government and a little more emphasis on sort of our collective interests and community and the fact that we have to do things together. And I think that that's always been the tension in America about what's the right balance to strike. And so I would agree with you 100% on that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. Let's take a look at some of the examples that you do put up in your book, and let's work backwards, shall we, because
sure.
In more modern history. And let's start with John McCain. What did John McCain help us to forge in our nation or in our national psyche by losing the election to Barack Obama?
Well, let me say two things about McCain. First of all, in the book, I lumped McCain, Kerry, and Gore together as the three most recent losers. It's obviously way too soon to see what kind of long-term legacy their campaigns have provided in American politics. And the way I look at them in the book is that what they are doing, I think, that's different is that they're sort of returning to an older tradition of how losing candidates ought to behave after they've lost. You go back 150, 200 years ago, you ran for president, you lost. There was not a great stigma attached to it. You just sort of went back to your old job, whether it was in the U.S. Senate or as a governor or whatever, and continued to be an active participant. But in the book, I sort of suggest that maybe it's the advent of television that made that stigma of losing so strong they become almost a pariah. Even if you have a lifetime good public service, a lot of accomplishment, because you've lost on this big stage of the presidential election, you're tagged as a loser, as a failure, and people want you to go away. If you think about Mike Dukakis, for example, after he lost in 1988, the guy was treated like a pariah. He couldn't even get a speaking slot at the 92 convention. And so what's interesting, so they would disappear. You know, Dukakis kind of disappeared from public life. Dole basically retired from public life. And so what I argue that Gore, Kerry, and McCain have done is they have tried to stay relevant even though they've lost. They're trying to reestablish this tradition that, yeah, I lost the presidential election, but I still am a public servant with a lot of experience, a lot to offer the country. And so McCain particularly, I think, has been very aggressive in sort of being a major critic of the man he lost to. Now, his concession speech was very gracious, and I think it was an important moment of healing and gave people the opportunity to take a second look at Obama, who maybe have opposed him. And so if you looked at what happened after McCain's speech, Obama's positives went up quite a bit because I think people wanted him to succeed, and McCain helped influence that. But then several months into the presidency, I think McCain decided to become what we used to call the titular head of the Republican Party. That is the spokesperson for the party out of power. And he became one of the harsher critics of the Obama policies, and I think he was trying to fulfill that role that nobody had really tried to do since Adlai Stevenson back in the 50s.
All right. My guest is Scott Faris. So let's take a look at a third party candidate that was very intriguing, and that would be Ross Perot. He ran in 1992. Now, why did you pick on Ross Perot, and what does he teach us about the losers in any political campaign for president?
What Ross Perot did is start a new trend of successful businessmen wanting to enter the political scene without any previous political experience. This is a nation that has always been obviously based on capitalism as well as democracy, and we often revere businessmen. And you think about all the famous tycoons we've had in history, Cornelius Vanderbilt, Henry Ford, Rockefeller, Morgan, all those names. People admired them for their ability in business, but nobody thought that their skill in business would translate into skill in politics. And so you never have any, for the first 200 years of the Republic, you don't have any serious effort to recruit from the field of business leaders to run the country. That changes, started to change in the 1980s when people started trying to urge guys like Lee Iacocca and Peter Ueberroth to run for president, and they both demur. But then along comes this Texas billionaire named Ross Perot who says, you know, I do think I'd make a heck of a good president. I'll run. And so he was entreated to run as a third party. He had a lot of devoted followers, and he did well enough that I think he encouraged a lot of other subsequent, very successful business people to believe that their skills in business would translate into politics. And so you've seen people like Steve Forbes, Donald Trump, Herman Cain this year, in California, Meg Whitman, Carly Farina, people who have no electoral experience, no political experience, but think that their managerial experience in corporate America is what the country needs. And I do think there's a big segment of the American population that thinks a CEO type is exactly what the country needs to kind of rise above politics, get above the typical politician, and try to solve our problems through some sort of CEO magic. And so I think that's his legacy to us today, as we're still seeing a successful businessman want to enter and a big audience who believes that's what the country needs.
All right. Well, I want to challenge you a little bit on that, if I
sure.
can, Scott, because in 1996, also in that race was Steve Forbes, a man that you mentioned in your answer there. And in many ways, Steve Forbes has had a more lasting impact because of his flat tax. We see that being repeated right now in the Republican nominees for the 2012 election. So how can you say on balance that maybe Forbes was better or worse than Ross Perot? What makes Ross Perot more memorable in that role?
Because Ross Perot actually, I think, had a chance to become president. You know, Steve Forbes stayed within sort of the conventional two-party system. He ran for the Republican nomination. Did okay, but obviously didn't catch fire. He tried again in 2000 and had even less success. So in terms of just the idea of promoting the flat tax, I wouldn't dispute that he had some influence, but there was never a chance that he was going to become president, whereas Perot really did almost become president in the sense that at one point, as you may recall, in the middle of the 92 campaign, he actually was leading both Clinton and Bush in the polls before he's a very eccentric man, and he suddenly withdrew from the race suddenly, later claimed that was because he was trying to protect his family from a Republican conspiracy to destroy his family's reputation. And then when he got back in the race, he just, you know, was viewed as kind of a flake and wasn't able to get back up as high as he was in the poll, though he still would end up with 19% of the vote. So he had the highest vote total of any third-party candidate since Theodore Roosevelt ran back in 1912. So I picked him, focused on him over Forbes, because Perot, running as an independent, actually had a shot at the presidency, however small that might have been, whereas Forbes never made it through the primaries to become a nominee of the party.
My guest is Scott Ferris, author of the book Almost President. Now, Scott, it's interesting in that last answer when you talked about Perot and the reasons for him pulling out was he wanted to protect his family. And that has become an issue here in the 2012 presidential election with the focus that has been brought on Herman Cain and Herman Cain's family. And that was the reason that he stated for dropping out of the race. Talk to us a little bit both about the winners and the losers and the impact that running for president or any political office, because you have experience in that, how running for any political office opens up your family and exposes them to all kinds of, well, people who want to dig into the dirt.
You know, I sometimes think we should have a constitutional amendment that everybody has to run for public office at least once just to find out what it's like. And maybe we'd be a little more sympathetic to the politicians we deride so often, because it's true. It's an extremely personal experience. You're right, especially the higher level you go, but it can also happen at some very low-level races at city council or a school board even. Your entire life is exposed and open for judgment by the voters, and that's kind of the agreement you've made. You say, look, I want to be a leader in our community and hold a public office, and so all aspects of my character are sort of open for dissection and analysis. And it's your name on the ballot. The people are voting on you. It's not a product that you've created. It's you personally, your character, that people are making a judgment on. And so it's a very intense experience. And when you do lose, it is a crushing disappointment because you know you have been personally rejected.
Mm.
And as you said, you do expose your family. And when we saw some people who didn't run, Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, chose not to run this year, apparently because his wife did not want their divorce and remarriage sort of open for public discussion. Obviously, Herman Cain had the misapprehension that he was going to be able to run for president and not have every aspect of his life scrutinized, which I think is one of the things that business people, again, just aren't kind of used to and why they don't always make very good politicians. And so that certainly derailed his campaign. So it is a very intense personal experience, and nobody should run without knowing that pretty much every aspect of their life is open to scrutiny.
Without a doubt. My guest is Scott Ferris. Scott, there are so many good examples in your book, but I'm going to cut to two that I found to be particularly interesting. One is Barry Goldwater in 1964 when he lost to LBJ. That was a seminal event in Republican politics at the time, and it's interesting that there's some parallels between the 64 election and the 2012 election that's brewing right now. So what did Goldwater teach us about ourselves as a nation and about our political system?
Go ahead. That's a question that we could go on for a while, but Bill. But let me say, I would say what he taught us was that there's. Well, let me just talk about what he did, and then we can sort of figure out what the lesson is out of that. Goldwater did two things for the Republican Party. One, he sort of represented the capture of the conservative wing of the party, and moved the party to the right into a new direction, and eventually led to the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. That's generally what he's credited with. But more importantly, I think in terms of long term. Is that what Goldwater did was he realigned the parties in a very fundamental way. The South had been solidly Democratic for 150 years or more. Many states had never voted for a Republican candidate until Goldwater came along. And the reason they switched was that Goldwater had voted against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which was a very broad law that prohibited discrimination in public accommodations and transportation and a whole bunch of things. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson, the Democrat, had pushed that 64 Civil Rights Act through as sort of a legacy to John Kennedy, who had become an advocate for civil rights towards the end of his presidency. And if you think about how one individual can make a difference, if the Republican nominee in 1964 had been Nelson Rockefeller, and he had been the favorite to win until he got embroiled in a personal scandal by divorcing his wife and marrying a wife's friend who was about 20 years his junior, and so Goldwater was able to really sort of just edged into the nomination by the narrowest of margins. It came down to the California primary, which Goldwater won. I think it was 52-48, something like that. If Nelson Rockefeller had been the nominee, he would have continued the Republican tradition of a strong civil rights plank. But because it was Goldwater, the Republicans reassessed what they thought the federal government's role was in terms of enforcing civil rights for African Americans. That allowed the Southerners, who at that moment in time was the seminal issue for the South, to move over into the Republican Party. And at that point, and I agree with that, there's some writers named Tom and Mary Edsel who've written an excellent book called Chain Reaction that goes into great detail about this. But the South had previously been economic populists. They'd been very conservative traditionalists in terms of social mores, but fairly liberal in terms of economic policies. But because the issue of civil rights was so powerful in the mid-60s, they sort of converted their economic philosophy to conservative in order to justify sort of becoming Republicans. And the South, which had been solidly Democratic for 150 years, has now for the last 50 years been solidly Republican. There have been a number of elections. I think it's been five presidential elections in the last 40 years in which the Democrats have been unable to carry a single Southern state. And that is the legacy of the Barry Goldwater campaign.
Oh, that is great. My guest has been Scott Ferris. He's author of the book, Almost President, The Men Who Lost the Race But Changed the Nation. Scott, it's intriguing. If people want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, I do have a website. It's scottferrisbooks.com. They can learn more about the book, learn more about me. I would encourage them, if they're interested, to get the book. It's available at any bookstore, bricks and mortar, online, and I hope they'll enjoy it very much. I think it's, again, it's an overlooked aspect of American history, and I hope that it'll encourage a new appreciation of some of these men who've been kind of forgotten because we consider them, quote, losers, when in fact, long-term, it turned out they were winners.
It is a very good analysis of our presidential campaigns from 1820 on. Scott, thank you so much for being my special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
Thank you, Bill. I really appreciate it.